Welcome to the Migrant and Diasporic Cinema Podcasts. Here follows a recording from our conference, The Industrial Context of Migrant and Diasporic Cinema in Contemporary Europe, which was held on the 13th of January 2007 at the Institute of Germanic and Romance Studies in London. We now hear Dr. Claudia Sternberg introducing Parminder Wirr, who will be discussing the move towards transnational funding, policies and networks.
In the 1980s and 1990s, she was a producer for television and made a number of documentaries with international themes, to put it briefly. She worked for the BBC, for Channel 4, but also the ZDF and Arte, so she's had contacts with European television. And I can't list the productions, but I would like just like to mention one very well-known documentary that she made that is entitled Algeria, Women at War, from 1992, for those of you who have an interest in Algeria, because we had this as a strand at the conference. She also founded her own production company and produced a feature film, Baby Mother, which is a very interesting film with too little dissemination or distribution, but it is available on DVD, so can I just say that if you have an interest in African Caribbean culture in Britain, it is set in post-colonial London. It's a feature film directed by Julian Henriques. Very interesting because of its use of the rhythms and the rhymes and the fashion of dancehall culture, a Jamaican influence, but in a black British context. She worked for a number of years for Carlton Television, where she produced the award-winning series Single Voices. Some of you, if you're British, you may know the series. It does what it says. It has a single scriptwriter, a single actor, a single character. So it's a simple way of doing very, very high-quality television. And that was a very successful production. But at Carlton Television, she was also cultural diversity advisor. And that's an important other side to Parminder. She's a producer on the one hand, and she will talk about the production side today, but she's also and has been a policy maker and a policy shaper. So this is, adds another aspect to our industrial context here. She was at the forefront of the Cultural Diversity Network, which is an industry-wide organization committed to diversity off and on the screen. So this is not just about representation, but also very much about employment and proactive measures to facilitate employment. She was board director of the very influential UK Film Council for a number of years, and she's currently a board member of the Department of Media, of Culture, Media and Sport, so what we Germans call a ministry. It's called a department here, and that's another interesting place at the heart of policy making, I would assume. She received the Order of the British Empire in 2002. For those who are not British, this is what the OBE stands for after the name. And I would like to say just one more thing about Parminder, because that's not really reflected necessarily in all these awards and in the titles and in the honours. Namely, that she's been throughout her career a great facilitator and developer of talent. And if you look at black and Asian British film in particular, and the very first and the very seminal films that were made in the 1980s, you will find her name in the credits. And this is an acknowledgement of how much she worked behind the scenes, sometimes as a producer, but also sometimes in this whole field, or developing field. And John Comfra just mentioned to me again that many things would not have happened if it hadn't been for Parminder to be around. And that's what he said. I didn't prompt him. So she was, when it was, you know, up and coming, yeah, she was already there, and she was always looking for talent, helping young people. And she's going around the world and lectures, which is what she will do today as well. And her aim is to encourage people, to motivate people, and to reassure people to keep going and work. And she follows all the changes for, or has followed the changes over 30 years, and that is an interesting perspective that we, I think, we will learn a little bit about what's going on now and what is different to past. Okay, thank you very much, Pamela. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Nice, all downhill from here, huh? You'd think, God, she's done all this. Why is she still continuing? And listening to Abdul Karim, you know, it almost brought me to tears. And I thought, I wish he lived in England. I wish he was here. I wish he had engaged with the struggles that we had engaged with. We were not defeated by them. Yet we did storm. We did burn the cities in Britain in the 1980s, not because we thought it was pleasurable to burn our neighborhood. But we thought it was one of the ways that we could express ourselves, yeah? And I remember when I organized the first Black Film Festival and talking to Imru Siza, and he said, well, Paminda, there was an expectation that we came here to sweep the streets, which is true, and that's what our parents came. And now we want to, you know, pick up the camera and we want to tell our stories. You know, we're doing it in theater, we're doing it in writing, you know, our visual artists are engaged. I'm talking about the Black and Asian community in Britain. But actually, we have now the arrogance to want to make films as well. And I think the opportunities provided by unrest, they saw it as uprisings, they saw it as riots, we saw it as uprisings. We used those to negotiate for us better deals, to negotiate a position at the table rather than on the sides of the table. And when I saw what was happening in France, I thought that's exactly what the Arab communities or the certainly the minority communities or the immigrant communities in France will be doing. But I also wanted to share with Abdul, one of the films that I am the most proudest of is going to Algeria, not speaking a word of English, not speaking a word of Arabic, but having read an article about having seen the film Battle of Algiers, seen what the women had done to shape and engage with the Algerian revolution, wanting to find out what happened to those women 30 years on. Yeah, did they still exist? Were they still in those positions of power? And had the privilege of finding those women 30 years on and interviewing them right at the time when they assassinated their president, President Boudiaf, who had just returned. And I was told by my commissioning editor at Channel 4, come back, bring the crew back. And I'd taken an Iranian cameraman, myself, who, and, you know, as a producer-director, and I'd worked with a local researcher to take me and introduce me. And one of the nicest moments was to meet Jamila Buherid and listen to her story about her time in prison when she was sentenced to death, in fact, yeah? But, you know, that just gave me, and we interviewed the three generations, the women who fought in the revolution, the women who inherited, and their granddaughters. And the reason I'm proud of it was that it was the first time anybody had come to Algeria to talk to the women and say, so what are you doing now? What happened in those 30 years? And it was shocking to find out what had happened to many of those women and the struggle. It was even more shocking that those women who had fought the French were now fighting their own brothers on the streets, yeah, in terms of the fees. And often it was within the family that really stunned me, that one brother was, you know, for the fees and wanted his sister, was a feast, and the other was much more a moderate and not a traditional Muslim. I mean, those conflicts and those contradictions were what the women were engaged with. Many of those women had to flee, in fact, Algeria and ended up in France. I did return to Algeria. I'm sure I was born in Algeria in my previous life. And to make another film with Mirzak Alouash, in fact, because I was incensed by the way that that the Gulf War here was being presented. And I went to Alan Yentob at BBC, as you do. I said, you know, there are filmmakers in those parts of the world, in Iran, in Iraq, in Israel, and in Palestine, that we are happily bombing, like, you know, as if no people exist there. Wouldn't it be good, you know, what would it be to get some stories from their perspective? And to my surprise, it was a 5-minute pitch, or no, it was a 3-minute pitch walking from one end of the corridor to the next, yeah? And at the end of that, he said, yes, who are the filmmakers? I said, I'll get back to you, because I did not know. I knew there were filmmakers. I knew I'd find them. And I did. I found Mirzek Alouash in Algeria. I'd never worked with him before. I found a filmmaker in Iran, phoned and found, and he said, yes, you know, we found the best documentary filmmaker in Iran. I found Rashid Mashwadi in Palestine, in Gaza, and an Israeli filmmaker in Tel Aviv, and we made 4 documentaries, which went out, in fact, as Algeria was blowing up in April 1991, 1992. So, you know, I mean, I also heard your stories about not finding the right producers and finding the right, you know, people. I think, again, I wish you, I mean, I, you know, the struggle of finding the right people to work with is here as much as it is in France. But I think it's important, you know, given that you are a filmmaker, to also begin to think about how you can work with filmmakers, with producers, with certainly financiers, and with also creative talent across and outside of France. That's because my third film that I wanted to make was about the Algerians who were of mixed race. And I can't remember who they were, what they are called, and they live in the suburbs. And I went to Marseille and I interviewed, went to the estates, yeah, where, in fact, where the likes of the big footballers have now emerged from. And that was the first time that I got a no to, that was going too far, you know. And the French, I noticed, never ever showed my film, the Algerian documentary about women, Algeria women at war. It was pitched to them to invest in it, and they did, I mean, to finance it, and they refused. They refused to commission it. They refused to... So I then structured a deal where Channel 4 gave me some money to make the film. They said, we'll give you half, which is always good for a producer, and you then run, and you think, you know, only I am to blame if I cannot find the other half. And I found ENTV, in fact, the Algerian television. And my pitch to them was, this is a film about women and the women who fought in the revolution. It's got nothing to do with what's happening in contemporary Algeria. Will you give me all the accommodation? Will you give me all the transportation? Will you give me all your archive? Because a lot of images of women, the mujahideen and the fighters that they have, free, and you will get a credit, and you will get the finished film, and you can show it on Algerian television. And to my surprise, they agreed. And so that's how I made my documentary. I share that with you, just that, you know, since my journey, which has been, well, I mean, you know, Claudia's really, really laid it out, that is really to say, where am I now, having begun in public funding, which is where I began to, you know, support the filmmakers like John Comfort, like Isaac Julian, like Julian Henriquez, in fact, who is also my partner. And it was really the, you know, being able to do that through the GLC. But it wasn't that the institutions were suddenly becoming responsive to us as black and ethnic minorities. It's that we were fighting for that, yeah? We had a collective voice. We were organizing. Whether it was the politics that were coming out of Race Today, the Institute of Race Relations, there were foundations that we had already laid which said, Britain, we're not here as visitors. You're not our host. We're here to stay. And you know, and these are the rights that we are going to be, that are ours, that rightly belong to us. So public funding was responding to that demand. And you know, being able to invest in, I think originally they must have thought that funding black artists and Asian artists would keep them quiet. But what they didn't realize was that we would use the money to actually tell very critical stories. And that's what the filmmakers did, that's what the visual artists did, that's what the playwriters did, yeah? And we have an enormous talent pool in Britain of artists who really did use their creativity, I believe, to make social, political, and cultural changes here. And the public institution, as well as the broadcasters, did respond to that. I also moved on, did a lot of festival programming, so it was really important that it wasn't just the films that we were making here that we were seeing, there weren't that many, but we were also beginning to see films that were being made in the so-called third world, which is what it was called then. And I did the first film festival called the Black Film Festival, which was bringing Black American independent filmmakers. And I was amazed that people like John Comfer and others who were at university then came to the Commonwealth Institute and supported that festival. And we also screened the work of Black British filmmakers. Those networks were really, really vital in screening each other's work, providing critical perspective on each other's works, analyzing it, tearing it apart, challenging each other. And also through that, with those solid networks, to be able to engage with the society outside. Because you're right, there are clubs, and how do you enter those clubs, yeah? And for us, it was to create our own networks from which to then be able to engage with the wider so-called British society, whether it was in the filmmaking or in others. But it's, you know, what am I doing now? I stopped making films in 2004, which is when I left Carlton Television, or rather Carlton Television left me because it was a company that was taken over by Granada Television to form the new ITV. Now you know all about the new ITV. And it's almost like that I had served my purpose, which was to engage the broadcast industry around diversity. But they couldn't see me also that I was a creative and quite a tenacious and quite a passionate and quite a determined film and television producer. And I think, you know, if we're talking about limitations and being put in boxes and how racism works in a subtle kind of way, and maybe it's not just racism, maybe it's sexism, maybe it's the fact that I'm a woman and they can't see that I can multitask and, yes, I can really lead passionately around diversity and change, but actually I'm also an executive producer and developer of creative talent. Anyway, I was told by my head of the human resources department, we're making you you're redundant. We no longer need a diversity advisor at the new ITV. But we'd like to keep you on as a consultant for one day a week. And I said, why? So that you can help us, advise us how we can engage more senior Black people into the ITV company. And I looked at her and I said, well, do you know you've just got rid of your senior most Black person in the company? And I, you know, that showed me that it just like, okay, it's time to start again. Yeah, that I had got so far. I was on the board of directors at the Carlton Television, which was the board that was responsible for the production board, yeah, responsible for all the programs that the company was making and broadcasting. I was also executive producing a number of programs. The series developed around Single Voices was just one, but there were many others. I launched things like the MOBO Awards, which were seen as a niche little award, which are now, a decade later, mainstream, yeah? And did a number of awards around celebrating multiculturalism in television, and the Emma Awards and the Carlton's Multicultural Awards. But, you know, even despite all of that and despite the track record that a head of HR can look you in the eye and say, we're letting you go and we need you to come back on a one day a week and advise us how we can change, how can we engage more creatively and employ more senior Black people. I was offered two things. One was to, you know, scream and yell and accuse her of racism, whatever, or just say, okay, fine, thank you. I don't need to be here. I've clearly done my job, and I need to now go away and rethink what is it, where do I want to take my skills and passions, or, you know, where do I move to next? And where I've ended up is one of the most exciting places. There's, again, something I've created. There's a company called Ingenious Media, which is really an investment company. It invests in film, television. It's a commercial company. So I've gone from public sector and all the work that I've done around programming, and I walked into this company and said to the chairman and the founder of the company, I would like to create a division within your company which invests in world cinema. And these are films that are coming out of and talent and markets from India, from China, from the diaspora, from Africa, and from Latin America. And I made a purely commercial pitch, and I said, where are the, you know, which where do we have the fastest growing economies? It's China, India, Brazil, Russia. We all know the BRICS now, yeah? What else is happening in those countries while, as those economies are really, really growing? And for me, it was talent. Some of the most amazing films have come out of those parts of the world that have touched the so-called international community. Some of the most talented cinematographers, some of the most talented writers and directors, from Walter Salles to Fernando Morales to, you know, Santosh Sivan to Deepa Mehta to Shekhar Kapoor, and I could go on, have come, you know, the directors of Lagan, etc., have come from those parts of the world. And we as audiences in Europe are consuming this stuff, yeah? It's no longer just us as the growing demographic. Remember, the black and ethnic minority demographics in France, in Germany, in the UK, in Holland are the fastest growing. You know, black people are still having babies, white people don't have babies. You know, the youngest population in the UK is Bengalis, you know, 80% of the 80% of the Bangladeshi kids are under 30. You know, so you're talking about a very young population as well, yeah? And what are they doing? They're consuming, they're buying, and they are asking for a diversity of content. They're no longer satisfied with just, you know, going to see. Yes, they will go and see, you know, the American stuff, the independent stuff, but they also want to see something, you know, where they feel there's a cultural connection, where the stories are reflecting them on the screen as well. So it took this guy precisely 5 seconds to say yes, because he can see, purely from a commercial point of view, that is really smart. If we, you know, that if we can begin to find the producers who are working with the talent that's a writer-director, if we can find the stories and we can begin to structure the financing and help the producer to put the financing together, and the key to that being distribution and being able to sell that film around the world. I wasn't asking him to invent a whole new model. I was simply asking him to say, you've got an existing model that supports Hollywood and European independent stuff. Majority of those are by white filmmakers. I'm just asking you to use the same model, but only we'll be making films, you know, in foreign language. They'll be coming from cultural places that are far and near, yeah? And they will be a combination of people who live in the West and are working with talent in the South, yeah, as well as the other way around. And so I really want to share with you some of my observations in the last year as I've traveled the world to put together my film slate of films, feature films, from around the world. And my sort of focus has been India, China, and I'll share with you some of my experiences going to Korea. It's the Middle East. It's Europe, of course, right, in the UK. And to some extent, Canada and the US in terms of the diaspora community. And what I'm seeing is the mainstreaming of the diaspora and the migrant experience, yeah, both in terms of stories, in terms of the issues, characters, and the talent. That's what, you know, and I'll elaborate on that. But that's not to say that, but what's exciting, you can only mainstream something if it's already happening. You know, if we take the record producing analogy, right? You know, when I was making Baby Mother, the people who made the music for the film were doing it from their sheds or their bedrooms, and that's where I took Channel 4's money. They thought that I was going to take it to sort of big studios to do my music. But Julian had sourced these amazingly talented, independent record producers, lyric writers, and they were working out of their, you know, their garages, their bedrooms, their friends' bedrooms. And that's where we made all the music. There were 12 original tracks on Baby Mother. So the money was actually being invested in community talent. And I believe in the two or three decades, just as people like you, Abdul Karim, who've struggled to make your films, just as when I met Walter Salles, I met him in 1993, and I'd met him before that in 1987 when I was in Brazil, or Octavio Bezerra, or even Fernando Moraes, we would sit in smoke-filled bars talking about the struggle of getting our film seen. When is the West ever going to wake up and see these amazing stories? Give us the distribution, give us the right marketing and publicity and get our films seen, or just even allow our films to be shown at film festivals, yeah? There was a time when one had two or three films in the London Film Festival from the so-called world cinema. At the last London Film Festival, I counted 90. So you can see what's happening, yeah? Many of them gala films, many of them in the main section, a bulk of them in the special section called world cinema. I remember in 1983 when I proposed to then the head of BFI that we should have a third world cinema section in the, and he refused. They refused. This was in 1983. We, and John Acumpra was an accomplice in this, we set up our own film festival called Third Eye, London's Festival of Third World Cinema. And we just rented three venues around London and showed these films. And we brought the filmmakers to engage in another smoke-filled room to talk about how tough it was to get our films made, right? But the point is, we thought, okay, you won't do it, we'll create our own network, and we did do it. But that for me, that's one of the biggest things, is that it's all that talent that had been making these films in the kind of independent struggle mode space are slowly also shifting into the so-called mainstream space. But the fantastic thing about people like Walter Salles and Fernando Morales and others is that they're not simply pulling up the drawbridge, which is, okay, you guys, we're leaving now. It was nice struggling with you, but we're now joining the Hollywood mainstream. But actually negotiating it so that they can retain their independence. And Fernando has done a fantastic deal where, yes, he has a deal with the studio. Yes, he will do a couple of studio films. But I noticed through his own company, and I know that because I'm reading a number of the scripts that he's developed through that, he's supporting a lot of Brazilian filmmakers. And there's one film that's come to me, which is very much developed by a Brazilian-French director with a British writer, and it will be a road movie set in Africa. But Fernando and Walter Salles has acted as the kind of executive and godparents to to that talent. And I am now joining that as the godmother, but as an executive producer, because I think it's a fantastic achievement to write a script on spec with no subsidy, no money, but purely by, being the vision of these two, the guys who've made it, yeah? And what he's also done is to do a deal so that he retains, if the film is made and is released in Brazil, he retains the revenues of film, of money that's made in Brazil. Now, I've just come back from Korea, where one film, which cost, I think, about $5 to $7 million to make, grossed $64 million in that country alone. South Korea has a population of 48 million. This particular film, and it's not just a mindless, comedy. It's a very serious film, actually, albeit using a genre, but a very serious film about South Korea's relationship and a very uneasy relationship with the U.S. and the U.S. domination and the presence in South Korea, yeah? But, it had 113 million admissions, so the Koreans went to see it over and over again. And that film has also been sold, the remakes have been sold to Universal Studios, yeah? The Departed, which some of you might have seen, was a Hong Kong gangster first, before it was remade. In India, for example, here in the UK alone, 16% of the UK's releases in 2004 were Indian films, not British films. There were more Indian films released in the UK than British films. And they made £12 million in that one year. Most Indian films, the Indian films with the star, and there are, those are the limitations of that because it's a very star-driven system. will make on average £2 to £3 million in a box office in the UK, and that's only from 50 screens. You know, in China, the film market is doubling. In South Korea, what's amazing about South Korea, the only reason they were able to get $64 million on a movie that felt like a first-draft script to me when I saw it is because they control their own domestic market. The U.S. majors are not, cannot just, you know, take over their theaters and release their films, yeah? 85% of that market, there's a, they have more days in which they can show their films than the U.S. 2 years ago, the Koreans buckled to American pressure and reduced the days from 170 to 120 or something. 10,000 people marched and said, no, you do not do that, yeah? We want to protect our industry. Because if you do this to film today, what are you going to do to something else tomorrow? When they went to Cannes, all the Korean filmmakers had this, these white tapes on their mouths, you know, which were saying that they were being gagged, yeah? That's the level of, you know, passion with which the Korean filmmakers and the film industry want to defend there. The other country, just look at Nigeria. South Africa is emerging as a filmmaking nation. But look at Nigeria. You make films for $10,000 to $15,000 or pounds, right? And then they make 100 to 200,000 copies, which are sold. They built up a film industry from nothing and nowhere, and it's worth over £64-65 million. Now, what is that? For me, that's doing three things. They are, you know, some of them are amazing. But what they've done is to grown. They've got an audience that they've built. Yeah, that audience will go, will buy the DVDs or the, or will go. I don't think they see them in the theaters, but they see them in on video, and they're shown on television. But they'll buy it. They're building an audience. They're building a talent. You know, this is a country that had no, I mean, yes, it had few directors, and I remember seeing a lot of the early 80s, and they're telling their own stories. That's the most, for me, that is the most important. They're the stories that people in Nigeria connect with. The emerging world is no longer in the grip of Hollywood, yeah? And the new markets and the new storytellers are challenging that. And they're actually saying, fine, this is the way you did it, but this is how we're, this is how we're making our films, yeah? And you know, and I really think that having some kind of protectionist policies are important, you know, in terms of allowing the Korean filmmakers to emerge, yeah, rather than a whole bunch, rather than seeing Korea as purely a dumping ground for American product. But if the two can work together, fantastic. But the revenue pie has shifted, yeah? 10 years ago, 80% of the box office value came from North America. So, you know, America was very comfortable in that, yeah? But today it's split that 40% of the box office comes from the US and 60% comes from the rest of the world. You know, you're talking about India and China. Just take middle-class consumers. In India, there's 300 million middle-class Indians educated who go to the cinema, right? And similarly, in China, that's the whole of the American population put together. And I don't know what percentage of the Americans go and support films, yeah? You know, and that is a really, you know, that is a really powerful shift, that America is no longer driving the revenue pie, that it is now the rest of the world. And the American studios are not stupid, because wherever I go, I, you know, in India, Sony, TriStar, Paramount, Universal, DreamWorks, they've all decamped to India, supposedly making local language films, yeah? And local language being that they'll make Bollywood films, that they'll, and primarily it's Bollywood films, yeah? Same in China, you know. They couldn't get, there's a quota, so because they couldn't enter China, they couldn't, you know, release their films because Chinese have put a limitation on it. So what's the next best thing? We'll open local shops. We will do joint ventures with companies locally. And, you know, but you know, there is a second restriction, which their revenues can't flow out of China. The revenues that are made, the money that's made in China must be reinvested in China. And China needs that reinvestment. Why? Because it wants to rebuild all of its theaters. There's a massive, massive drive in China and India to build the infrastructure for screening. So out have gone the 3,000 flea pits in which we used to watch the films in India in the 1980s, right? And in have come these amazing swanky, Electric Cinema has nothing on them, multiplexes, yeah, where you can be wined and dined and watch a movie, or, you know, you can have a choice of 10, 15 screens in any of the cities, yeah? So the cinema-going experience is changing. And in China and India, and Korea, actually, they're leading in terms of the number of cinemas that are being, and similarly in South Africa. So the Americans went in there and said, okay, we'll co-produce locally, and we will help to build the infrastructures. But we will take the U.S. rights. So they invested. So, you know, and most of the films do well locally, but, you know, then there are exceptions that also break out. There's a bizarre film called Kung Fu Hustle, which, you know, Sony had put money in to make for the local market in China, and then suddenly discovered it was a breakout film in America, and it grossed hundreds of millions of dollars, and it was made for a tiny, tiny budget. But, you know, but also, I mean, I think for what I find fascinating is that European films and filmmakers are looking for their place in this new paradigm. You know, it's no longer the discussions we used to have in the 70s and 80s, which is how can we penetrate the British or the European distribution exhibition funding structures, yeah? It's the other way around. And the traffic between here to there is phenomenal, yeah? You know, whether it's co-productions, co-financing, co-development, co-ventures, but also that new networks are emerging in these countries, which is what I find fantastic to be able to go to. So it's not just going to the film festivals in Europe, but actually going to the markets in India, in Frames, or the Asian film market in Busan, the another Asian film market in Hong Kong, in Singapore. Dubai is positioning itself. I haven't been to Dubai, but I've been following very closely the emergence of the Middle Eastern filmmakers, yeah? And Dubai is saying that we can help to bring, you know, and provide a platform for Arab Middle Eastern filmmakers to emerge. What the price will be, we can certainly talk about that. I think also, you know, for me, you know, the films that I'm looking at is, if, you know, I look at the creative, but I'm also looking at now the finance package. You know, how is this film funded? You know, who is actually investing in this film? And the kind of money and the kind of sort of financing structures that I'm reviewing is that the film will come in, if it's coming in to me from the developing world, from the emerging world, is usually equity-led. So you know there's a lot of cash in these countries, yeah? I.e. it's pure equity. There are film funds that are prepared to invest in films, which means there are wealthy property developers or industrialists who are seeing film and the media as another investment opportunity to have as part of their portfolio. So a lot of it is usually equity-led. Then there's usually the bank, and it's interesting that banks like Standard Chartered, HSBC, or Deutsche Banks who would never have opened the door to a filmmaker, are now saying, yes, we will invest in films, yeah? So there's usually a bank there somewhere in that mix, yeah? In countries like India and China, where there isn't necessarily a subsidy, there's usually tax incentives. So that's another way of that a film is financed. But it's usually one or two financing. It's never, you know, 20, 30 players trying to finance a film. When I look at a project that comes to me from a Western producer, but destined to be made in China or India, or as I'm looking at a film for Argentina, and another one, the African project that I was telling you, is usually multi-financing. And it usually leads with subsidy, soft money, yeah? So, you know, there's a difference between 20 agreements that I have to look at with a Western producer. And equity is usually a tiny bit, with some pre-sales to distribution companies who've said, yes, we can see that this film, yes, we will release this film in our territory and we will even pay. And that's, you know, and that just, that really is equals that these countries, you know, countries in, you know, that there is a lot of liquid, there's a lot of money in one part of the world. And we are actually struggling for money in Europe to make our films work. I guess, you know, finally there's the markets, there's the diaspora markets, yeah? I mentioned that the fastest growing demographics, whether in the UK, whether in France, is the non-white communities. It's the same in Canada, it's the same in Australia, it's the same in the US, yeah? Those demographics, my parents were quite happy to watch mindless ITV when they first came to the UK. As soon as ZTV came, my parents switched. They never watched. And this was my father who grew up on BBC News, and that's about all he would watch. But they switched, and they've never gone back, yeah? So people begin to say, okay, we do want a mix with, you know, we do want to, the audience itself is driving in terms of the demand. They're demanding culturally diverse, culturally authentic, culturally complex stories. And my challenge when I was working in television was to get the broadcasters to see that, yeah? And to get them to see it from what they were missing out on. The same is happening in the film world. I think just to, you know, there's one area which is around policies. I am a non-executive director of the DCMS, and one of the critical things that the DCMS is having to address, which is never done before, is what is our cultural foreign policy? How are we taking our culture abroad and our creative industries? And those are the two areas that I'm particularly helping them to develop strategies of. How do we engage with China? How do we engage with Korea? How do we engage with these new markets? Yeah, what is our competitive edge now in the creative and the cultural space? The other department that I'm working with, which is where I'm going tonight, in fact, with the delegation, is the Department for Trade and Industry and the UK Trade and Industry, which is a kind of the division that does outward, which is, you know, taking missions out and engaging. And this particular one is looking at how we can do business with India. It's interesting, we've had 350-year history with India, and yet you look at people as if they, you know, they behave as if India is an alien territory, yeah? And yet we speak the same language, there is a cultural connection, you know, and yet it feels like a very, very different space. And you think, what, you know, and we talk about multiculturalism, yeah, as a term, but have we really learned about each other even when we've lived with each other? And now we are being forced to engage with each other in order to do business. Ken Livingstone, you know, we know all about his Cuba trip. He went to China too, and he's about to go to India again because he sees London's relationship with India, with Delhi or with Bombay, and particularly Delhi, as a really vital one. I think I feel very optimistic. I think the two challenges are distribution and the sale. I think financing and developing talent, particularly around the production sector, particularly producers who can not only cut deals but and also can develop creatively, are the challenges. But I think those challenges are going to be really addressed by technology. That, you know, there are now I think we can make our films, tell our stories, and create the platforms ourselves on which to distribute. And I think the generation of filmmakers that are now coming up, it's a very different time to when the John Acumphers and the Isaac Julians and I, you know, we entered this field. I think it's a very exciting time, and it does require thinking not just in the diasporic European box, but actually it does require us to shed that static about foreign, about the other, and actually begin to engage in it in a real way. Sorry, I don't want to speak.